Hello, and welcome to the Nurse Researcher Podcast. This is Series 3. This is the NIHR Senior Research Leader Series, and do press follow wherever you listen to your podcasts. Listen right until the end, where we'll host a summary with Professor Roxanne Crosby-Nwaebe, and do leave us a comment wherever you listen to your podcasts. Thank you. Hello and welcome to the Nurse Researcher Podcast, and joining us again is a senior research leader from the NIHR for our third series of the podcast. So I'm going to introduce and say thank you for joining us, Tracy Long.
Hi, nice to be here. Thank you for the invite.
Delighted to have you. We've met at SRL events, and Roxanne, you were one of her chosen few to do the podcast. So tell us your title, your role, and where you currently work.
So I'm a nurse consultant and I work at the Children's Care Group at Rotherham, Doncaster and Southumber NHS Foundation Trust, which is known locally as RDASH. I'm a senior research leader, like you say, and I'm on cohort one. And I'm a PhD student at the University of Hull, and I'm exploring transition to adoptive parenthood. So, yeah, that's me.
Okay. Now, we're not going to get too far ahead because we're going to delve into that. And I never let anybody come on this podcast without firstly telling us, why did you become a nurse, a health visitor? How did that come about?
I think it's probably, if you don't mind, I'll probably give you a little bit of context, a little bit of background. And I think probably I've had to address some adversity, so overcome some adversity in my background. At the age of 12, I was told by a teacher, "You'll never become anything." And this negative comment, I feel, contributed to my school leaver exams. So I left school with failing all but two. I passed English and art, but I left school with quite a negative view. I had quite a bad experience, I would say. I went back to college and I resat the exams, and I worked hard at these, and I found that was the right environment for me. So whilst at college, I also worked as a healthcare assistant, and I sort of thought, well, this is quite good. And that's when I became involved in nursing. So I applied for a entry into nursing, sat an entry into nursing exam. I started my nurse training as a general nurse because that was what you had to do back then. I started as a general nurse and I qualified in 1993. And then I went on later to do my paediatric nurse training and later qualified as a health visitor and subsequently became a nurse midwifery council teacher. So to train health visitors to become safe and effective practitioners. So yeah, a real different journey into nursing, really, and based on the, like, quite a bit sad, really, when you think about, you know, from being such a young child to having such negative thoughts put about you, about your future, said about you, about your future. And that could have gone two ways, really. And Thankfully for me, I chose to use that and take it in a positive light.
Yeah, sounds like it almost become an inspirational thing to do, to sort of almost prove that person wrong. Did you ever get to go and tell them what you'd become?
No, I wished I could have, but no, I never did. And yeah, she still sits there in the back. And I certainly think that influenced how I teach people. It certainly influences how I support new nurses, student nurses, any learners, you know, from any discipline, any background, it doesn't matter. I think the way that we care for our nursing workforce is really important. And I think that stems from that early, very early, significant message of you won't become anything.
Yeah.
Well, actually, we all can become something. And we just need, you know, to apply ourselves, and we need the right people around us. And I'm lucky because that's what I've had.
Yeah, absolutely. And all credit to you for that. Part of me wishes I could sort of take you back to go and see this person now,
Yeah.
but putting them to one side and not making them any more of the episode. So, at what point did you feel empowered enough to think, well, actually, I am quite academic. Once I've applied myself and I've been encouraged and I've had the support, when did you first realize that you had academic ability to go with your clinical role?
So I'm one of these people that say I'm not an academic. Or even to today, sitting at the computer doing a PhD, I am believing in myself now, and I am even saying I'm a qualitative researcher, which I sometimes shock myself when I say it, but I am, and I am academic, and I know that I'm academic, whatever that means. But I think what I am is proud, pragmatic, and determined, and I think those being somewhat academic, I'll say, and having those qualities has definitely helped. But I don't think where research has been concerned, it's been easy. I did think it was something that other people did. I did find it quite a grey subject, and to be honest, I am one of those practitioners who found research quite scary. I performed my master's. And I will say performed it because it was never something that I set out to necessarily do. It felt like it was something that I needed to do in my career to progress. So I did. I performed it, and I never really thought, well, I'm going to add to a body of knowledge of something like I do now about my PhD. There's a definite shift there. But yeah, I suppose looking back, I suppose I lost my fear of research when I undertook a service evaluation. And that was definitely a gateway for me into research. It wasn't research, but I definitely used research skills. Do you want me to share a little bit about that service evaluation?
You can do, yeah, of course, yeah.
Yeah, so it stems from this goes way back to about 2011 when I was a practice educator. And we had a group of health visitors who were qualifying that year. And we also had a group of health visitors who were leaving the workforce because of the pension reforms. So we saw a real imbalance of a potential risk. And that's when I set up a community of research practice, sorry, a community of practice for these newly qualified health visitors. And it was a way of supporting them through their first year in practice. And what I did after that was we ran that for a few years. And then I actually looked at doing a service evaluation to see how that had worked out, really, to see was it had it been useful. And it was from there that I actually did my first publication. So we did a service evaluation, used some research skills, and then wrote that up. That became a publication. And then that gave me a bit of a buzz thinking, well, actually, I've just added something to something. I've just found, I've just evaluated a piece of work that we've done that nobody else has done that I can find. And yeah, and it evaluated positively. And we've done something in our trust that has actually helped these practitioners. And I think for me, understanding that actually research can be generated from qu questions and issues of practice and built upon has been really instrumental in driving my way forward. And I think from that point on, I sort of had a bit of a light bulb moment and just thought, that's different. That feels different. And it felt really good to have done that. And then following that, I applied for for one of the internship programs, so the Integrated Clinical Academic program. And I actually was successful on that. And I used that to then develop my skills in research. So I'm quite aware that other people might know more than me. I'm quite aware that my students were qualifying and having skills that I was starting to think, well, I don't know how to do that. So I used the internship program specifically to learn a skill that my students had, and that was searching for literature using the database searches, because historically we hadn't done that. So I took a subject, and it was authentic leadership, and I explored that with the support of a supervisor, did the internship, and published another two papers, one about being an intern and then one about the authentic leadership.
You'd
And
got
then
the
it's
bug.
just
You'd got the
I'd got
bug
the
of it, didn't
bug.
you? Yeah, I
Yeah.
can sense it.
Yeah. So it just sort of rolled from there. And then I did apply to undertake a pre-doctoral fellowship to go on and do my doctoral. So I'm now starting to think actually this could be something. But unfortunately, both of those applications that I put in were unsuccessful. And probably looking back, they were probably premature applications. But what they did say was there was a need there within the subject that I had identified, and I took that then to my care group director and to the head of research and to the head director of research and the head of learning and development, and they supported me then to do my PhD. So it's not been something that's been planned. It's not been something that I've had like a timeline of I must do by. I've sort of just, I suppose, fallen into things as I've learned and as I've developed and as I've grown as a person. I think one of the biggest shocks to me was when I did really want to do research in practice, was how close I actually got to leaving practice, because it was really challenging to try and get a job that aligned to practice, aligned research to my practice. And I really wanted to dovetail that research into my practice. And I so very nearly left the NHS to work in academia full time. And I'm so glad I didn't, because obviously I've had other opportunities, that I've been able to see practitioners develop their research skills. When they're just in the same position as me, trying to develop research which aligns to practice. So, yeah.
And just tell us the sort of title. I know you don't have to have a final title of a PhD until you submit it, but what's the rough idea of the title for your PhD?
So I'm looking, so my title roughly is Transition to Adoptive Parenthood Using Reflexive Thematic Analysis. And the subject came from a personal and a professional clash, really. So, professionally, as a practice educator, I was the lead for Transition to Parenthood. And that's part of the high impact areas that health visitors work to. And it's all quite it's quite biologically driven. And I'd never really given adoptive parents a lot of attention in my mind until I became one. So I became a mum by adoption, and so that really questioned my professional knowledge versus lived experience, and the two didn't align. So that's where the PhD subject came from. I started to do a little bit of digging, started to just question what was out there on this subject, and I took it from there, really. So, yeah, I'm excited to see the end, and I'm excited to hopefully influence policy and practice with the findings from a PhD. But I definitely hold those adoptive parents at the heart of this, 100%. Yeah.
And going back to where you started and where you are now, I mean, you talked a little bit about not being academic or having to sort of find your way with that. And I think sometimes people think academia is all about sort of a very sort of academic intelligence and a
Yeah.
place where you sit and an ability to, to run through your GCSEs and your A levels and get a
Yeah.
top degree and all those sorts of things. But actually, there's an element of almost resilience required for a PhD, isn't there? The longevity
Yeah.
side of it. And we use resilience incorrectly sometimes in the NHS. It's a bit like, can you work in a horrific situation and not moan about it? Great, you're resilient. That's not the way, is it? Resilience is
No.
sticking with this, and
Yeah.
demonstrating that actually what's the driver for this is not the academic merit, but actually the cause for you.
Yeah.
It's that fact that this is something very close to home, and you're aligning the two. You're aligning the planets, aren't you, of the lived
Yeah.
experience and the role you do as a professional. So there's no greater driver than that for this, and academia is almost secondary to your passion for the subject.
Yeah, completely agree. And I think that's made the PhD all the more, I won't say easier, but all the more enjoyable. I've really enjoyed this PhD. I've been able to, I suppose what I'm good at is I treat it as part of my job for a start. So I am very, in the sense of I'm very structured in the time allocation to my PhD. And I work, I almost work everything around each part of my role has a place. But I do keep the adoptive parents and therefore their children they're looking after at the heart. So they're central to this. They are absolutely central to this. So, you almost, it's hard to explain, but it's moved from it being about what I know about what as my experience now. It's what I know based on other people's experience, either through literature, through the systematic review that I've undertaken, or the concept analysis that I've undertaken, or through the data that I've collected. And I have a real sense of ownership now of this information, and I want to look after that information and get it to where it needs to be as adding to the body of knowledge about adoptive parents' experience, and that's really important to me.
And
And so
rightly.
yeah, it has definitely taken away that academia and that's a process, and I'm working my way through that process. But at the heart of it is babies, children, people, and families, which is what I've worked with for forever.
But you could have felt an expert by association. You could have thought, well, anecdotally, I know exactly what I need to know because I am an adoptive parent. But what you've done now is you've sort of been, you've put yourself in a position to say, actually, from an external validity point of view, I know what I know because of my wealth of experience of the research in this area, the field of this area. So you've moved from anecdotal evidence to evidence that you're generating yourself, that research evidence.
And I think that's really important as well because it demonstrates to other nurses actually we all have a lot of experience in say in practice or with our own families or just life that actually there are a lot of unanswered questions, and that's where nurses are really good at understanding actually why do we do something this way? Why do we still do something this way? What's the evidence to support that? Nurses are really good at working that out. So yeah, I would definitely recommend it. But I think people do need to be in the right headspace, need to have the right support around them, and and it does take a lot. It is a lot, but to do a PhD. But I've got brilliant supervisors. They are brilliant. I'm not just saying that. They are brilliant. They get what I'm researching and why, and I've got a good team in work as well. So I've been supported to do that, and that belief's been there, and that I suppose that empowerment to just do it, just get on and do it, which is it's quite nice, it's quite refreshing, and
So
liberating.
you're a busy clinician, you're a busy parent, you've got your family life, and you're in the midst of a PhD. Why'd you go and choose to be an NIHR senior research leader at that point?
So I'd had quite a bit of experience leading around research. So locally, I lead a community of research practice for research interested practitioners within the children's care group. And regionally, I co-lead the 0 to 19 research network with peers from other trusts and across region. And I will just give a shout out. We've just won the Nursing Times Award for public health nursing. So, and that was on a
Congratulations.
2-year project. Thank you. It was a 2-year project where we collaborated to build capacity and capability of school nurses and health visitors. But yeah, so we're really proud of that. But yeah, so for me, while I have been developing research leadership, but I think what I was lacking was some of that greater networking. So what I felt the SRL program was able to offer was that greater networking with other senior research leaders across England to really broaden my horizons, to broaden my connections, to link me in with people who had similar interests in research or came from similar backgrounds. And it's done that. But I think ultimately I wanted to raise that profile of nurses who work in community, who work with babies, children, young people and families, because they are underserved, as a group of clinicians, but the families, the communities that they work with are also underserved. We don't necessarily have research written for us. So that doesn't give us a lot of or typically doesn't give us a lot of experience to lead on or deliver research in practice. So I did feel like the SRL program was a way to fly the flag for specialist community public health nurses and other community nurses working in non-hospital settings, and also for my own development, career development. But I must say, I didn't think I would get. I didn't think I would get the SRL in cohort one. I thought I maybe have to keep applying, so I did have to do a little bit of juggling when I did get the program placed. So, but I was absolutely thrilled, absolutely thrilled.
And how's it working out? Because I've joined cohort 2 this year. You're cohort 1, so you're heading towards being 2 years in. How's it worked out? Is it what you expected it to be? Have you been able to develop what you wanted to develop?
So I think for me, the big, I suppose, the objectives, I've got objectives and they all align to building research capacity and capability. So I have a special eye on health visitors and school nurses. That's my discipline. Public health nursing is my speciality. But yeah, it's to build a to continue to build a research culture within our organisation, and we're definitely getting there. We're now a site for two studies. We've put in for others. We're trying to develop practitioners through like on the first steps into research program or the internship program or pre-doctoral, just raising awareness constantly about what opportunities there are outside of the trust, as well as those that are available within the trust. And it's just, I suppose, just raising that profile of research so that it doesn't become something too big. So it doesn't become something that's scary. So actually, the practitioners understand that they can do research and practice and not get to, sometime down the career pathway and think, well, this is something other people do. Well, actually, no, it's something we can all contribute to. So we're looking at we've still running the community of practice. We've tweaked that slightly, so that's now research and innovation community of practice, and the innovation's been added just so that we can potentially pull people in who are scared of research but aren't scared to develop practice or innovate. So we're trying to take a whole team approach to research within the care group. So it's also broadened my network in terms of the trust. I've always had really good collaborations with the Grounded Research Team, which is our local research team. And I've collaborated with them on a number of projects. But actually, being a senior research leader, it's enabled me to sort of highlight conversations around things like the use of certain tools, Victor tool being one, the SORT tool being another, and have those conversations, and it come from, I don't want to say a legitimate place, but it comes from, it's evidence-based. It comes from, all the senior research leaders will be using the SORT tool, for example, within their own organisation. I suppose it gives you that collective voice as senior research leaders, as opposed to somebody just trying to do this on their own, which is so much better.
And it's a respected title and badge, really, isn't it? There's that sense of, I've noticed in my short time that people sit up a little bit at that title, NHR Senior Research Leader. Oh, because they're not easy to get, are they? No awards easy from the NHR. So it does
No.
give you that little bit of legitimacy.
And
And
kudos in that sense of, I think for me, even just having the NIHR lanyard has made a big difference. It's been a talking point. So the first year, we didn't have the lanyards, and then this year we've gained the lanyards, and there's a definite difference. And it sounds silly, it's a lanyard, but on the lanyard it says NIHR Senior Research Leader. So people within, within and outside of the organisation will ask, "What's that about? What's that role?" And it gives you the opportunity to explain that actually this is a program funded for nurses who are research leaders, and but it also gives you the opportunity to say it's funded at an 8B, which is a fabulous opportunity to develop further and to gain that recognition. And you've got that protected time, and that protected time is really important because you do find that you fit things in, but actually to have those 2 days where you can really focus on your outcomes and what you want to do with that program, I've really enjoyed it, and it's I'll be really sad when it ends because obviously I'll start my 3rd year in April, so it's thinking what next, isn't it? It's what do you do next? So you don't want to you I think I'll always have a tie-in now, though. That's the thing. I think there's a group of nurses now across England that actually, in the same way as the 70 at 70 nurses, there's that alumni formed, and there's that group of people out there now who we know and we're connected. So I don't think that will change. So it's just working it all out, isn't it? What comes next?
And what will be
Because with
su
a
yeah, I was gonna say, what would be the mark of success for you then? So what would be your marker? So you get to the end of the 3 years, what do you hope to have achieved?
I think we're already achieving it because we are a site now for studies, and practitioners, because of being a site for studies, have been given opportunities that they wouldn't have had previously. So we're set up now to deliver certain studies. We've got a room that's ready to support that. We can have one-to-ones about research. We've got lockable cabinets, which we didn't have specifically for research. We didn't have that room. I think for me, it would be seeing other people developing. So a good colleague of mine says you don't want to be a single point of failure, and that's what I don't want us to be. I don't want it to just be one person driving forward something, and I know it's not that now, but it is. It's about, because we do work strongly as a team. But what we've had from those research studies is we've had the ability for practitioners to develop as develop research within their roles. I've become a principal investigator, and they've learned from that. Dialogues with research teams, study teams. It's just been very useful. So we can already see some of the benefits. But I would like to see other people developing in more of a research role within their role, and I know that's not easy, but certainly utilizing the ICA program, First Steps program, even having people on PhDs, developing that, but really trying to embed the Chief Nursing Officer's strategy for research. I think if we can, even if we focus on certain parts of it, I think the starting point will, well, the next steps will be the SORT tool, understanding where our baseline is, and then working forward from that with a next step plan, really, for e either within the children's care group or wider within the trust.
It sounds fabulous. So I suppose my last questions for you, it's two parts really, a short term and long term. What's next for Tracy Long? I'm sure short term is going to be Dr. Tracy Long and getting that PhD over the line. But what does that open for you, and what do you want to do? What's left for you?
So I think, yeah, absolutely. Finished my PhD. I'm not there yet, and I'm not taking my foot off the throttle yet with my PhD. I want my PhD to inform practice, definitely. I want to take the recommendations and really fly them high, get them in the appropriate journals so I can really attract commissioners' attention of the subject, and so obviously attending conference and further publications. I want to continue to grow my track record within research, so I know where my gaps are. I'm learning where my gaps are. I want to continue to be a visible research leader. That goes without saying. Do you know, if I was to dream big, I would want to become a professor of nursing, but I know that's not an easy ask. I want to be a professor of nursing in practice. And I think probably the next step postdoc would be looking at something like the Advanced Clinical and Practitioner Academic Fellowship, where I can a postdoc where I can develop my career in develop the academia side of me. And also maybe because I'm a nurse consultant, think about how my practice aligns from a in a postdoc position. But I think these are very when I speak to other people who have either done PhDs or are doing PhDs, these seem to be common themes. It's actually what do we do with the now? At the end of this program, this process of being on a PhD, and I'm in my sixth year, so this has been a part-time program, so it's lived with me for a long time.
And that's the resilience we were talking about, isn't it? It's that sticking power or staying power, if you like, to keep with these things. So finally, I mean, you talk very positively about the SRL. You can see the passion. I can see the passion in your face when you talk about your PhD. So for people in your position that might be thinking, actually, that it's too much to take on, or people junior to you thinking that actually I'd like to be a senior research leader for these reasons, what would be your tips to people?
Well, first of all, I'd say if anybody's negative to you, ignore them in that sense, from the, in terms of the negative comments I had from, don't take that throughout your career. Think positive, be determined and plan. I think the biggest thing I've done is network and connect. Massively important, because it's really hard to do something in isolation when you're trying to do something by yourself. I mean, I'm really lucky, and I would definitely recommend other people. People need to find those, they need to find an anchor. And by that, I mean that person or those people that they can connect with, those people that can empower you, those people that actually can see your vision and support that vision. And I've got that in abundance. I definitely have. I've had that within the trust within my own workplace. I've had that now within the networks we've developed as a community, especially as public health nurses. And I've got that wider now with the SRL program. So I definitely would say to others, network, if that's locally or if that's regionally, definitely network, make those connections, read. Constantly read, look at what's available, what opportunities there are for people at different career stages. I mean, it's so different now to 5, 6 years ago. There's so many more opportunities for nurses to get involved in research. How see who the role models are. Have a look at your own disciplines and see who the role models are, and try and connect with them. Try and observe what they've done, and and build from that. But plan. Just baby steps forward. Maybe start with finishing a master's degree, and then publishing or taking it to conference. But yeah, I say plan, but none of mine really was planned. It's just happened.
It's
Just
just
by circumstance.
well, and your ability. It's because of you, isn't it? So against adversity in those early years, and despite everything else, you've become the role model that you want people to aspire to be, and you want people to look out for. And I would say, Tracy, it sounds very much like you're a credit to yourself. So
Thank you.
shoulders held back, confidence, push on for that PhD and continue in that SRL role. So all that's left to say is, Tracy Long, thank you for your time. Thank you for speaking to us.
Thank you very much.
Hello and welcome back to the Nurse Researcher Podcast. And we're here again with new guest summariser, Roxanne. Roxanne, welcome back.
Hello and welcome. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, yes, and a Happy New Year to the listener, because I don't think I've said that before. So yeah, that's thinking about where we are in the current calendar. It is a Happy New Year, and this episode goes out in January, so we're still okay to say that. What an episode, Tracy Long. Where do we start? If I give the bookends that I thought we'd got here, I think you can fill in the gaps. But we've already talked before this episode about that almost terrible message that she received as a child about almost amounting to nothing, a very toxic message we'd probably describe it as these days. And then the end of this episode, we talk about her ambitions to be a professor. So it didn't hold her back, did it?
It absolutely didn't. And I was saying to you offline, I'm going to have to find another word, some synonyms to fantastic to use by the end of this SRL program. Because these individuals are so fantastic and so inspirational. And I was quite chuffed that she built up this resilience and she didn't let this toxic comment at the beginning of her career stop what she was capable of doing. And then she's used her learning from that experience to impact and to influence what she does now with her current mentees and, you know, in every sphere of life, what she's done. She's built up a fantastic 0 to 19 network, a community of practice, and she takes the time to pay attention to every single one, what their learning needs are, involving everyone in research. You know, she also spoke about using the underserved community. So she identified that it's not just underserved in terms of a nursing background in the community, but also their access to research and the population that she served were not being served by research. So Tracy has done fantastically well. And as I said, I need another word for fantastic at the end of this.
Well, perhaps you do, perhaps you don't. I mean, does it show that the shortlisting process for this, you got it right? Because across the cohorts, that I've done a few more interviews that we haven't got to yet, but really ambitious people that I've dealt with adversity often are people that are in sort of nursing and midwifery roles. Tracy sort of really puts that across, doesn't she? That actually, she had to sort of go up against this sense that people didn't rate her to some extent, particularly in the early days as a school child. But that fear of research that she talked about initially really drove her, didn't it? That became almost that gave her the desire to want to progress.
Yeah, completely agree. And I think I'll just harp back onto that toxic comment. And it's more for our viewers and to more and listeners and to validate Tracy's comment. So it's really important that we, yes, acknowledge what this person has said, but internally we need to analyze that comment before we internalize it. So is that comment edifying? Is it going to improve me in any way? Was there anything in there that I can constructively, you know, listen to and work on? And if there isn't, we literally have to say, probably not externally and not out loud to the individual, but we need to decide your opinion is none of my business and quickly move on. Because these toxic comments can really grind down and, you know, hold people back and keep them, you know, in a lidded jar, keep this glass ceiling, this, you know, that people say that we're supposed to have. These comments can really erode somebody's self-confidence. So I'm really proud of Tracy, you know, to be able to move on from that quite quickly and to progress in such a fantastic career.
Yeah, and I'm sure she's had support. Well, you could tell she'd had support from the un from you know going from an unsuccessful pre-doc to having the backing of her leaders and managers internally to support her to do an internal PhD. So she's had support and she's had backing, but I felt it was right to say to her at the end of this episode that you're a credit to yourself. Because often
Absolutely. She's
you can
such.
be a credit to other people, but she's done this, hasn't she?
Yeah, and she's such a role model. And I just can't tell you how proud of I am of her. You know, being able to set up these networks, speak to these individuals, increase capability and capacity for research within her trust. And now she's thinking of, you know, becoming a professor of nursing. You know, how many of us who are professors of nursing actually thought we'd get that far? And she made this comment about, you know, being able to fall into things. And then at the end, she talked about, you know, probably we should do some planning. Yes, it's great to plan, but sometimes the devil could be in the detail. You plan and plan and plan and don't get there. But like our previous SRL, Angela, she didn't plan for anything. All of her second chances actually worked out. So, you know, we need to let our listeners know that, yes, you can plan, but if it doesn't work out, that's okay. You know, I believe in God, so I believe that, you know, God delivers. People who don't believe in God believe, you know, that faith happens or life happens. So therefore, either which way you believe, there is always a way to move things forward. So yeah, I can't say how proud I am of Tracy for being able to ignore the negativity, you know, do some planning, but she also advised about doing shadow placements, seeing individuals who you think, you know, can assist in your career, who you may be able to give you advice, and moving forward with them, contacting them, networking. And she also spoke about the opportunity on being on the SRL program as a large network. So not only what she's done in her local patch, but she's able to influence others, and other people's journey able to influence her as well.
Yeah. And I think, you know, with it being the Senior Research Leader series, I'm always keen to bring that, obviously, to bring that in into the episodes. She's a natural leader, isn't she? She talked about the service evaluation, the internship program. So she climbed the ladder in her own sort of incremental way. The knockback of an unsuccessful, what I suspect is a pre-doctoral bid, and then the internal support to do a PhD that resiliently she's done in to the point where she's in year six now. But then when I talked about the SRL role, it was clear that she, because as I'm sort of on the outside looking in, I'm thinking, God, you're in the middle of a PhD. You've got this role to do. Why would you want to be a senior research leader at the moment? Because you've got enough to do for yourself at the moment, and you're already doing leadership. And she was very clear that she was already a leader. But that's why she wanted to have really the badge and the sense that she could do this on a grander scale, wasn't it? That the NHR and the Senior Research Leadership Award would network her. It would give her the national feel to be able to sort of give back what she's doing on a broader scale, but equally work with others as well.
Yeah, and you tend to find with all these leaders, it's not about themselves, it's about others. And yes, yeah, she's progressed in her career, done these courses, had some knockbacks, came back, but she quite quickly spoke about on the SRL program wanting to network, wanting to work across a wider patch, wanting to involve everyone in research. And being on the SRL program was a form of kudos. So she was able to be at the table and not ask to be invited, but she brought her own share to the table because she was recognized as a national leader. And yeah, so she's able to influence locally. And then, yeah, you know, having that SRL badge, she's able to walk into a room, command respect that she probably wasn't given before, but now it's definitely hers. She was able to, you know, open doors for herself and open doors for others.
I love the fact that she mentioned the lanyard as well. You wouldn't think that would make a difference, would you? But the fact that she's now got the NIHR Senior Research Leader lanyard, which she wears clearly with huge pride, and is able to say, look, this is what I am, and here is the badge to say it. So I know that that's a new thing with the NHR to provide these. And it's wonderful that she thinks that actually that's an important thing, that she has that label that she can demonstrate to people, this is what I am.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's great that the office was able to provide it. And I think it's a bit sad that with everything that she's done, she has to rely on a lanyard to, you know, to advertise who she is. However, we use what we have with great pride and with aplomb.
Yeah.
And, you know, if this is what is required to open doors, we are very happy to support that. But I hope we will get to a stage where people's actions speak for themselves.
Yeah, I'm sure we will. We'll get there, won't we? Then that will always be the aim. You're always having to drive. I mean, you're always having to drive and prove yourself, but you want it. You don't want these to be barriers, do you, to opportunity? Mm-hmm. What I liked about Tracy's story as well was the sort of internal value of what she was doing. So alongside that senior research leader role, she's still in the heart of this, what is currently a six-year PhD pathway. And that was so meaningful to her because it was related to her home life, that she is a parent of adopted children or child. I'm not quite sure, but that was the what really pushed the PhD, that transition to adoptive parenthood. So there isn't just that professional ambition there for her. There's also that personal ambition. So it really, I could see on her face, and unfortunately, because we do podcasts in that audio way, nobody else can see what I saw, but I could see the dedication and passion in her face about this PhD and about this role that she has now with the leadership.
Yeah, I think that's quite common in nursing, isn't it?
Mm.
And the desire to be able to apply your clinical knowledge to your practice. But we are also individuals. So therefore, you know, things that affect us will influence what we research and how we research. And I'm quite proud of her that she's and quite happy that she's able to recognize what her own experiences are and be able to bring that to the table in terms of the type of methodology she used to address her PhD.
Yeah.
But also, because she is an adoptive parent, and because that's a topic that she's actually researching, it's going to be even more applicable to the people that she's interviewing, and the outcomes will be even more applicable to her population, because she actually understands the topic from the inside, but also from the outside. But also, you all, as a qualitative researcher, you always have to recognize your own biases. But she's able to use both ends of the spectrum and both sides to influence the care that she's going to be able to give to her patients and the people that she works with.
I mean, she's a stakeholder as well as the researcher, isn't she, in her own research. So yeah, and in some ways that can make it a little bit more difficult because, like you say, of your own biases and your own perceptions of things. But that's where the research training of the PhD comes in, isn't it, to help her to separate that. But like you, I don't know Tracy as well as you, but I was immensely proud for her listening to this story, and she has overcome adversity, and we'll end the episode not by mentioning the teacher directly that sort of shot her down as a young girl, but both of us agreed, didn't we, that we wish we could take her back to meet that teacher and just go, look at her now.
And more importantly, just present the teacher with that Nursing Time Awards. So it's a quite a lovely glittery trophy, just out of just giving her a copy to put on her mantelpiece.
And we won't delve into it, Roxanne, but we had a little chat beforehand that you had a similar toxic comment from a teacher, and boy, did you prove them wrong.
Yeah, we did, and yeah, me being 17 years old, I didn't think I'd changed very much, but I took my O-level certificate back to that teacher and gave her a copy for her mantelpiece as well. So, please don't follow me, but yes.
No, that it sounds like the right thing to do, and there are lots of stories of that. It's good to use that negative things to positively motivate people, and if that's what you have to do, I think that's a good lesson for children at school, and it's a good lesson for nurses that feel like sometimes there are big obstacles to overcome. Then, use that as your motivator.
Definitely, and we need to look out for our role models. Just going back to the lanyards, if Tracy's lanyard works in practice to attract individuals who have no experience in research or some experience and they want to move further, look out for it. Tracy is definitely there to assist and to help and support. But again, to our younger listeners, people coming up within the research career framework, the whole research awareness. Listen to the
Absolutely.
comments, please be respectful, but then recognize, are they going to help my career? Are they meant for evil? Are they meant for good? What is there anything constructive I can glean from this? And if there isn't, quickly move on. Do not allow someone to dull your shine or to stop you from moving ahead where you need to be.
Great. Yeah, great message and an important lesson, isn't it? Roxanne,
Yes.
thank you for your time. Another episode summarized, and I'll be saying to you, no doubt, on to the next one.
Yes, I'm looking forward to the other three in the series. And you did mention that we handpicked these individuals, and I don't want the other SRLs to think that they're not as great. But it's just the reason that we handpicked these few individuals is because they're from different specialties. So we had Angela previously as a midwife, and now we've got Tracy as a health visitor. So we'll have different specialties, but all of my SRLs, and I call them my SRLs, all of the people on the SRL program are supremely special and great leaders.
And just for the other SRLs that might be listening, when you say we pick them, the we isn't me. I wasn't involved in the picking. I don't want them to think I was, as an SRL myself, I wasn't picking people.
Maybe for it, fair enough.
You pick them, not we. It might be you and other people, but certainly not me. I haven't picked the people. This is very much your series and dedicated to the
But
program.
all the SRLs have demonstrated via their applications, that they're doing leaps and bounds and lots of things in their area. So we're just highlighting different specialties. But hopefully we'll have a second series and we can bring more individuals on.
Roxanne, thank you for your time.
Thank you.